Hello.
Hello.
Is this on?
Heather's friend gave us a loaf of zucchini bread.
Oh, I love zucchini bread. With or without walnuts?
Well, good point. What I was about to bring up. It has walnuts in it, and I think it has... No, I guess it is just walnuts. Thought for a minute it might be chocolate chips, which I am not a fan of in breads and muffins.
Yeah.
Or pancakes for that matter.
Yeah.
Sorry, I was just trying to get, I thought I had another minute, so I was just trying to get that down.
it's all right. You know, the sounds of your chewing, it's lovely. It's hypnotic, really.
You know what I learned how to play the other day?
Chopsticks. Oh, okay. God only. I was thinking, it's like, is that the theme from Welcome Back, Kotter? Oh, that's lovely.
Oh God, it's so good. It's so good. It's like,
yeah. Now, was that you just rewinding and playing, rewinding, playing, rewinding, playing, or did you have sheet music?
For this one, I found somebody who transcribed it, because God only knows is a weird harmony. Like, oh, I could have taken the time to figure it out. No, it's actually, I was having this conversation with somebody the other day. God only knows is one of those songs that sounds really simple. Because it just sort of flows so sort of effortlessly,
mm-hmm.
but is really kind of weird when it comes to harmony.
So is it, and this is coming from a non-musician, mm-hmm. is it the choice of sort of chord progression and melody? Because it doesn't sound like, from a technical standpoint, it's all that difficult, and I could be way off base on that.
It's not difficult to play. It's just complicated to have written.
Yeah, okay.
It's not the kind of thing where I couldn't teach you how to do it.
Right.
But if you sit down and want to analyze what's actually going on there, it's weird.
Well, and I think, you know, that's an interesting part of sort of genius, right? Or that term that we ascribe to musicians, especially. It's not necessarily that it's hard to play in some cases, but it was hard to come up with those notes, those chords in that way. That's the genius part of it, not the technical nature of it. Is that fair?
Yeah. And I think that particular song, you know, if you listen to a lot of pop music, it's, you know, you're 1-6-4-5-1. It's like all very straightforward diatonic chords that are like in the standard key and all the rest of it. Usually just in there. There's a lot of chords in there where it's a D chord over the fifth A. So it's, you know, first chord is it's not D. It's, so there's tension even in the first chord, you know, there's tension all over the place. There's like these notes that kind of aren't what you expect. And then they resolve usually chromatically.
Hmm. You know, and it's not quite dissonant when you're listening to it.
Yeah. It's just like, it's like a little dissonant, like, oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
But not enough to make you think. I mean, this is why he was who he was, you know, Brian was a genius, and that is one of the greatest songs of all time. And it's just, it's nice to hear a song that is so lovely and has all this complicated stuff going on behind it, but you can totally enjoy the song and not know all the complicated stuff that's going on behind it. Hmm. I like that about it. Yeah, God only knows. I was always like, I need to learn God only knows. And now I know God only knows.
Well, I always loved the story of the party that they played the acetate for Pet Sounds.
Yeah.
And you've got Lennon and McCartney in the back room, you know, playing it over and over again, going, what can we do? Wait a minute. What is this? What's happening here?
Yeah.
You know, and then they go and write Sergeant Pepper in response. That's kind of cool.
McCartney still says that God Only Knows is his favorite song.
Yeah. Yeah.
Which is
saying something, right? Come on.
I mean, it's one of those songs. I don't know if it's going, it was rivaled in the 20th century as far as like just a pop, beautiful, like love song. It's like, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
It's right up there. Anyway, but that's fun. Back in New York City, this is On Taking Pictures episode 378. I am Bill Wadman. That is Jeffrey, the sorcerer Sidoris.
The sorcerer. What? Look, I wear the hat one time out in public and then it sticks. Jesus.
People don't forget.
I've been thinking about something that we talked about. So Bill was down in DC and was able to make some time, and we met up for lunch, which was great because we don't get to see each other very often. And I've been thinking about something that we talked about. And I think there's maybe a broader discussion. You were talking about the show that you do with your friend Sandy.
Yeah.
And how audiences have changed, and if we started this podcast right now,
yep,
the likelihood of it finding an audience right now is probably pretty slim.
Yeah, I don't even know how you would do it nowadays.
Yeah. And it's not because it's not interesting or we're not, whatever. It's just, when we started this show, and you mentioned something that
I think it's just too many people.
I think there's only so many hours in the day, and there are only so many ears, and those ears are going to go where they're going to go. When we started this show, there weren't, tens of millions of podcasts out there like there are now.
Right.
But one of the things that you said that got me thinking was, we got on a network pretty early on.
Yeah.
And I think that helped tremendously. And I was thinking about other kinds of sort of not necessarily networks, but official or I guess it's official bodies that makers can belong to that in some weird way gives legitimacy to their work. Right.
Okay.
And I was thinking about like Magnum, or, if you're an Associated Press photographer,
sure,
that somehow elevates you more than just an independent. But as those institutions either get bought up or fail or get dissolved or whatever it is, where does that legitimacy come from? And I think it's the same thing kind of in the art world. If you're repped by Gagosian, for example.
Sure.
That's a banner. That's a, hey, I'm at Gagosian.
But
I'm
get dropped by Gagosian.
Same kind of thing. Like what happened
cuts
there?
Cuts both ways.
Yeah. And I've been thinking about it for the last few days about where does legitimacy come from in the eyes of the market other than reach? Or has reach become the new barometer of everything?
Well, that depends if you are... if you believe in that the idea of, I hate the term, but gatekeepers, idea of, you were hired by this magazine, so therefore you are, you were hired by New York Magazine, so therefore you're somebody now or whatever. It's the problem with the engagement thing is that not all followers are equal. You could have 1,000 amazing, serious people following you, or you could have 1,000,000 bots. That is not the same thing,
No, but to some people, yep, hiring managers, yep, if they see, X number of million, they go, oh, wow, that's millions. Mm-hmm. I saw an interview with Seth Rogen the other day, and he was talking about Superbad. Right. And how
I
that
just
movie
quoted
could
super bad.
Did you really?
Yeah. When I said people don't forget.
Oh, right. People don't forget. Yeah. Right. 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 How that movie could not have been made today.
Right.
He said that, they sold the movie to the studio. The studio gave them a budget. The studio gave them a target date for release and largely left them alone to go cast the movie, to go make the movie, to go direct them. Like all this other stuff were variables. And he's like, you could not do that today. They want everything bundled up and ready to go. Yeah. And they're going to look at casting and they go, well, is that that might not be the funniest person, but this person might have better reach, and that's going to get us more money.
This guy's got 600,000 followers. This other person has 6,000 followers. We want the 600,000 followers because they will market the movie on their social media.
Exactly. Which may or may not be real. Right. And I think we're seeing more and more that it's really not real. And I just thought that was like this whole thing around the illusion of reach. I've been thinking about, and as somebody, you know, starting out and deciding I want to be a maker of some sort, whether that's a musician or whether that's, you know, a writer or a painter or a photographer, whatever it is, like who, other than reach, what gives your work the legitimacy that certain aspects of the market still feel that it needs before they will hire you?
Sure. A long time ago in the maybe 2009, 2010 era, I got asked by my friend Randy to speak at this organization called PAI, which is Photographic Arts and Images or something like that. And it was like, oh, come give a talk about your original 365 project. And, you know, it was a bunch of mostly older people at the time there. But, you know, after me, it was the next week, it was Saul Leiter. And after that, it was, yeah, I mean, they, you know, the serious, serious heavies would come in and speak. And so I was I'd be honored to. And I got to see a lot of people there. And I remember some of the women that I met there, some of the women, not specifically, there were some women there who I started talking to, and they were members of ASMP, which is the American Society of Media Photographers. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And at the time, to become a member of ASMP, you had to be recommended by a member and then seconded by another member.
Oh.
Like it wasn't just
a country club.
You join, yes. You have to be sort of vetted. And one of them said, I love your work. Like, you know, would you like to join ASMP? And I did. And, you know, I forget what the couple hundred dollars a year or whatever it was at the time. And it meant something because there weren't that many of, not everyone was a member.
Mm-hmm.
And then a few years later.
Wait, back up for a second. I'm not sure I understand the women connection.
Oh, those two women were members.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, and they were just, and one of them said, I'll sponsor you. And the other one said, yeah, I'll second that. And I was really?
Okay.
And, you know, that would be great.
I wonder, back then even, it might be worse, might be better now, but I wonder what the ratio of female photographers to male photographers in those kinds of organizations was.
Good question. I mean, probably still predominantly male. I mean, a lot of that stuff, especially. And the idea of ASMP was that these were editorial photographers and journalists and things like that. And for me to be a member of that and have it on my website or whatever, you know, member of ASMP.
Right.
It's sort of like, oh, other people who do this think he's good enough to be one of them.
Right.
There was some value in that association. Right.
Okay. So where is that now? Where does that come from now?
Here's where I was going. So a few years later, obviously there's a far less work for editorial photographers nowadays, magazines disappearing, blah, blah, blah. ASMP,
which is ironic because we're bombarded with imagery 24/7.
Yeah, but not in that structured way that we were before.
Yeah.
And they ended up changing their rules at some point in the mid-teens to allow anyone to sign up, including wedding photographers and like kid photographers and stuff.
Without the recommended and seconded?
Yeah. Okay. Because they wanted the membership numbers because they were somewhat of a lobbying organization, right? So we need the money, we need the amount of members or else we don't have any power. The problem is that the value of being a member goes down if you open it up to everybody because that's not what it was.
Right. So it dilutes the importance or significance of having a member of ASMP on your website.
Yeah. And I remember I was up at the farm, the Eddie Adams workshop. And
Do they still hold those, by the way?
Yeah. I was up there and I was sitting having lunch with this guy. And it turned out he was the president of ASMP at the time.
Oh, really? And you didn't know that?
I didn't know it when I sat down with him, but I found that out. And I... I mentioned my, I said I used to be a member, but honestly, I like pulled up when it didn't give me any, I didn't get any glow from it.
Right.
The way that I would have before, you know.
Did he respond?
Yeah. I mean, I think he was basically saying that it was either that or we die out, you know? And I don't blame.
That's an interesting thing to be faced with. Either we grow and number and lose our relevance.
Yeah.
Or we hold the line and we lose our relevance.
Yeah. Yeah. And
really,
you know,
weird. Wow.
And you know, I don't blame them, but it became less valuable for me, so I stopped being a member. But I remember when I was tapped by those women and then got in and had my little press card and everything.
Mm-hmm.
Man, that felt cool. You know, like it was, I was in with the cool kids, as it were.
Well, yeah. I mean, and it's, I mean, you can see it in photography, there's Magnum, right? Or if you're Aperture, or if you've been featured at ICP, or I mean,
sure.
Do those things still mean? I mean,
no.
Magnum has been kind of tarnished over the years.
I'm
right?
sure
the reputation.
Sure, but I'm sure these things do. I mean, if you're a member of Magnum, I'm sure there's still that's still, you know, a few dozen people.
Yeah. Does it open doors, do you think, like it once did?
I think the bigger question is whether Magnum is doing okay as an organization.
Yeah.
With the death of media photography and that kind of thing, you know, people are not buying documentary photographs the way they were before. I mean, I think the surest sign of it is looking at the fact that Magnum, where do they make probably a lot of their money now, is selling prints and books
the print sales that happen a couple of times a year.
Yeah. And then they're the books with the contact sheets and stuff. I mean, they're sort of relying on the relevance, their 20th century relevance, to maintain a patina, which, and I mean, it's funny because I was actually looking, I was talking to my friend, Matt Carr, the other day, and we were driving around and I said, man, there was an ad that I saw years ago that was a picture. It was a magazine picture. In fact, I'll send it to you. I remember Seven, you know, the organization, had an,
I don't know that organ. What is Seven?
Oh, they're
you say Seven, I think Fincher.
No, they're an agency. They're like another journalism agency. It was James Noctway and Gary Knight and all these like heavy people.
Okay.
Seven of them started back in 2001, and there was a Canon ad of them, and I just texted it to you. There was a Canon ad of them. It was then Nine Photographers, probably because they were just like, wow, we're a bunch of white guys.
Oh, wow. Look at that. Yeah.
And I remember seeing this photo in you know, some magazine or whatever it is. And I remember it's stuck in my head because like, I still think I take pictures trying to make them like that one.
Huh. That's funny.
And it turns out, I think it was actually taken. I think it was taken by Christian Witkin, who was an assistant of Coupons back in the day.
Hmm.
Funny enough. And a friend of
Wait,
Coupons.
Wait, so is this something promoting
Canon.
Them or Canon? Oh,
Canon. Oh, Canon. Yeah, okay. Canon was sponsoring, I think,
okay,
the organization and giving them,
okay, I see.
Yeah, they were giving them cameras and whatnot. Yeah. Anyway, but it's funny that like in my head, that organization and those people were, you know, these fancy sort of cut off from like a splinter group from Magnum, basically, that started their own thing, kind of, you know, it's like, but wanted to do the same kind of thing. And started in 2001, and it's like, I don't know if they're still around. I have to look. I don't keep up with this kind of stuff. But I remember thinking, oh, look at them. They sit in French cafes and they shoot. They go to war zones. They're in Rwanda taking pictures of whatever, you know, whatever the thing is. It's
Brad
not my
Pitt
world.
And spy game, right?
Exactly. Yes. Yes. Exactly. Yes. Exactly. and I guess there maybe was some reality to that at some point.
Mm-hmm.
But
does that feel like it's largely gone?
And yes, if so, absolutely.
where does the street cred come from if there's no longer informed critique or it's all just numbers?
Let's say that it's numbers. What are those numbers meaning? I mean, nowadays, whether your stuff gets pulled in and shown to anybody else is all this algorithmically created nonsense, right?
Hmm.
And so what, unless I make reels where I show you my camera bag and what I'm packing in there, you know, whatever, right? Like, because that's what people want to see.
It's picked on numbers, not the quality of the work, right?
Yeah.
So who are the new sort of arbiters of taste and quality?
Well, you know,
that mean anything, not just sort of these, you know, camera ambassadors YouTube influencers or something.
I saw, you know, yesterday there was a thing that popped up in my feed about this like young guy in Sweden or Switzerland or whatever the hell it was who got straight A's and ended up having a Fulbright scholarship to MIT and like super smart guy on his way to like take over the world and chemistry and whatever. And then he was working at a nightclub trying to make ends meet. And Grace Jones came in and told him, no, you should just quit all that stuff and become an actor or model. You're too good looking. And that person is Dolph Lundgren.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he made the decision to go to Hollywood and start dating Grace Jones or whatever.
Yeah.
Instead of going to MIT and a Fulbright scholarship. Wow. And, you know, here we are years later. Now, if Grace Jones had not walked in that day, would we even know who Dolph Lundgren is?
Maybe.
Life really just that sort of capricious, you know?
Or on the other side of it, what have we missed out on from his brain, from his thinking, from his mind in that arena? Because he made that choice.
Absolutely. I
mean, what discovery or what research or what, you know, invention could have come out of his brain that we don't get, but we do get, you know,
Rocky IV.
Crush you.
Yeah. I worry about that, but I think you're totally right. What I really come down on in the end is that I don't know if there's any rhyme or reason to any of it. And I wonder if there really ever was. Even the people who are in Magnum, are they in Magnum because they were the best photographers? Or are they in Magnum because the right person met the right person at one time and liked him when they went out for a beer?
Well, yeah. I mean, look at you with ASMP.
Exactly.
Did those two women look at your work or did they just go, hey, this guy's cool. Yeah, I'll sponsor you. Oh, yeah.
I mean, they saw my work and they did. But unless I got called by Randy to come talk to that group, they would have never seen me.
Yeah. So is it all just happenstance?
I think generally you got to be, you know, the classic thing, you know, yeah, you got to have luck and things have to happen for you, but you have to be able to do the job once you get the tap.
Mm.
I think that is true to some extent still. And there are some amazing photographers out there on the internet. If anything, I think it just shows that the world doesn't need as many photographers as we do.
Well, and there are, to your point, there are amazing photographers that we will never hear of.
Of course, yeah.
Because their work isn't getting pushed out, or artists or writers or, you know.
It's always amazing to me when I hear about somebody and I go look them up, say, on Instagram. And sometimes they have 600,000 followers.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you look and they've got 6,000 followers.
Yeah.
And I'm like, hold on a second. How the hell does it... You know,
it
seems like there's no actual correlation between. And even that, though, even the huge amount of people following you on social media. That is very similar to what we started with is talking about the podcast thing.
Mm-hmm.
If you went on to social media now trying to get a big following versus the people who were on there in 2009, when the hell does Instagram start? 2015 or whatever. Went on there early and maybe got highlighted by Instagram when they were trying to get people to come on there. Oh, you should, you know, you should start following people. How about what are you interested in? Photography. You should follow Jeffrey Sidoris, right? You know what I mean?
Right.
And there are those people who have huge followings, not because they're necessarily any better than anybody else, but because they were there early and somebody at those organizations gave them the nod.
Yeah. Right place, right time.
Yeah. And so, you know, I mean, I think we both know some people who fall into that category.
Well, and the potential reality of that is what's messing me up. Because I think it gets back to what you just said is, in a larger sense, does any of it really matter? And how much control do you have over it?
And if you are on the outs of that whole thing, is it your fault or the universe's fault?
Yeah, right. Yeah. I mean, these are the questions that keep me up at night.
Yeah. I mean, I don't, you know, I have friends who have far more followers than I don't have a lot of followers on Instagram. Yeah. 5,000, 4,000. But I also don't post there all the time. I don't put up reels except for every reel once in a while when I just think of something silly. When we were down in DC, we met up with, our friend, Dr. Ali Mattu.
Oh, right. Yeah, that's right. You said you were going to, what was it, dinner that night? Yeah.
And
how'd that go?
It was, oh, man, we had, there's this place called Centralina there. Do you know this restaurant?
In the hotel?
No, it's like a block and a half south of the hotel. And that there's like this east-west alley that goes between those buildings there.
Yeah.
It's called Centralina. It is not a cheap restaurant. But I had what I think may have been one of the top three meals of my life.
Really?
On Friday night. It was excellent. They have a different, they change their menu daily.
Like the bear.
Yeah. They come up with what they're going to make that day based upon what they got in that morning.
Wow.
And so I had this.
That's
actual art in food. Yeah. Right? You know what I mean? Yeah. Like that, I will give credit to. That's
what ingredients do we have? What can we make with it?
And I will tell you that I had this tomato on top of this crostini kind of thing that they made. And it was the best tomato I've ever eaten in my life. It was so good. I've never even tasted tomato that tasted that good.
Did not come from Giant.
Yeah. Anyway, we were there with our friend Ollie, who I have known since he was in grad school. So I've known Ali Mattu before he was Dr. Ali Mattu.
Yeah. He was just student Ali Mattu.
Exactly. And, you know, he was at our wedding, you know, like we're friends with him and we were at his wedding and, you know, friends with his family and his kids. Like, and, you know, we're sitting there and he was there because he was being interviewed by Soledad O'Brien for the APA keynote series. You know, because he's a psychologist. And, you know, he's sitting there and he's talking to us and like, you know, he's just Dolly, but I go look him up and he's got 500,000 followers on YouTube.
Wow.
And part of it is because he posts all the time. Part of it is because he's posting about the things that people want to hear about in psychology, but it's also he's posting the kind of stuff that works on social media that way, you know? Why do you feel stuck? What about your depression? Why are you unmotivated? How do you get out of bed in the morning? Like all these kinds of things, right? That people are
universal, aren't they?
They're universal. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's smart. And
it's not like, you know, how do you add grass to text?
No. Right. Know, or something. I believe that he is sincere in what he's trying to do, but even if you weren't, you could gamify that.
Oh, and many have.
Sure.
I mean, we've all seen the horrible AI voiceovers on whatever topic that's just designed to get numbers.
Exactly. And so, you know, and we're sitting there having dinner, talking about our personal lives and professional lives and what have you. But, you know, one person at the table has 500,000 followers on YouTube and the other two don't.
Right.
You know.
Do you feel, and this is going to come out wrong, but.
By the way, I did feel incredibly proud of him in the moment.
Yeah. Well, and that's the other side of this.
I'm like, Ollie Mattu, look at you.
Look at you. My friend, look at him making good.
Yeah.
Is there any sort of, well, wait a minute. How did you get there and I didn't? Is there any of that?
Well, I did have a friend say to me the other day, he said, you know, whenever anybody says, all you got to do is, you know, make good work and put it up. And then I see you do it for 1,000 days straight and your numbers don't explode. Yeah. And that just disproves the fact that, you know what I mean?
But Casey Neistat does it and he gets, you know, he sells his company for $30 million or whatever.
Exactly. Yeah. Right. Right.
And that see, that's, that gets to, you know, this whole ideology of, and there are people selling courses around it and writing books around it going, you know, find somebody who's doing what you want to do and getting the results that you want to get. Do the same thing and you'll get the same results.
Not true.
Which is absolute horseshit.
Yep. Because there were probably 15 people doing that same thing, or 50 people, or 1,500 people, and there's one or two of them that make it.
Yeah.
It's a survivor's, whatever it is. What's the term? It's you know, you think that you were successful doing it this way, so you think that's the way to be successful.
Right, 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 right.
And it's just, that's not necessarily how it works. Now, then the question becomes, okay, so I am somebody who, let's say I want to massively grow my social media because that's the way to get ahead in the world. Okay, could I gamify it and just do, I don't know, let's say things about creativity, things about photography. People do these things. We've seen a billion of these things.
Sure. Come out with a preset pack, you know, all that kind of business. Sure.
Would I be good at that? I mean, I think I could do it. I think I would have a hard time. I wouldn't have a hard time doing it as in I wouldn't be able to, I don't have the skills to do it. I would have a hard time doing it. I would feel disingenuous doing it.
Yeah. I would think you would have a hard time reconciling the fact that you are doing it.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
Well, and that's kind of the thing, right? Is you see so many, you know, all you have to do is make a digital product, sell it on Etsy, sell 7,000 of them, and there's your retirement. And you're like, right. Well, okay.
Yeah.
Mm.
I don't know that it, I mean, I guess it could, okay. Even if that is the way it works, that's not how I want to do my life. Right. You know?
My opinion, but chime in. We could have done much more to promote this show and maybe get more on the rankings and get in the, you know, blah, blah, blah.
Although every time we got listed on some podcast of the best photography podcast top 10, and we were on most of those lists.
Yeah.
We didn't even find out about it until after the fact.
Yeah.
None of that was us trying to push it or.
No. And I don't think you could look at our numbers and see spikes when those things came out. I don't believe that.
Yeah. I never looked. So I don't know.
Yeah.
But this gets back to the other thing we were saying the other during lunch is, you know, are we doing this for the numbers or are we doing this because we enjoy talking to each other and we enjoy doing it?
Well, I'll be honest with you. And I said it's about the numbers for you. Yeah, right. And Bill, we need to have a talk. No, I said to Bill, I said, I'm enjoying this iteration of the show much more than I did probably the last 2 years of the original run because the value proposition is different. My expectations, my goals around it are different. And I think to your question, I love just doing it for the sake of doing it. We don't even look at metrics. We don't, you know, we're not running an ad scheme. Like, could we? Sure. But it has become something, it's gone full circle, right? I think when the first few episodes were like, hey, let's just roll tape and see what we get. And then it was like, oh, we got on a network and then we started making money and then we started making enough money to cover rent and bills. And then we thought, well, wait a minute. This is, and then it dropped away and then it changed and like, you know, all the other shit that happened.
Yeah.
But we could continue
to chase that if we really wanted to.
Yes. But I think it's come back around to let's just get on mic when we have something we want to talk about.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a chance for, you know, one of my closest friends and I to sit and talk. But and that's pretty cool.
It is totally cool. And I think that ultimately that's what should be, you know, but this quickly gets into an era of, do they actually mean that? Or are they just trying to play up the faux authenticity so that
I don't think anybody listens to this show.
No, I don't think anybody listens to us right now.
Questions that.
But if you just suddenly heard this, you could say, oh, you know, they're trying to do the marketing thing where they're not going for numbers. They're actively
Oh, yeah. You know what I mean? Yeah, yeah.
So all of this can be played and twisted and whatever up the wazoo. I will tell you,
letting go of chasing numbers or sponsorships or brand deals or any of that stuff that, to be honest, I was trying to chase years ago.
Right.
I just don't care. And it's not real. The people who listen to this show, the people who send us emails, Tom in Michigan, who sends us voicemails, you know, anybody who, you know, takes time out of their day.
Great. Now we're going to get another voicemail from Tom in Michigan. I heard you guys mention me.
Yeah, right. Hey guys. Anytime we get an email and we've said this so many times, the emails that we get are not, hey, love the show. They are pages of people talking about their lives with us. That means infinitely more to me than, hey, stamps.com wants you to do an ad read.
Sure.
For whatever.
Sure.
You know, and I think, you know, and I'm grateful to you, well, for a lot of things, but for being willing to just come back around and just have these conversations again for the sake of having the conversations.
Yeah.
And just that little bit of connection every once in a while, that means more than the metrics. Because I think I don't want to gamify our friendship.
No.
And I think at a point, it's not that I necessarily wanted to, but I felt like that's what we had to do to keep the show relevant or I don't even know what.
But I don't think our show was ever fake.
No. I'm not saying that at all. I'm saying that the goals, you know, and I think maybe it was because we had a taste of, you know, running ads and getting paid and all that. And it changed for a little bit. It changed the trajectory.
Sure. But it became a job less than.
Yes.
Sure.
And now I think we're back to, we're back to just doing it to do it. And yeah. I'm grateful for that. I really am.
Yeah. And you know, it is interesting that the people who are super fans, for lack of a better word, who found out we were recording again, we got dozens of messages from people. Oh my God.
Yeah. Which is, and they keep happening. People still are finding this new batch of you know, episodes. Like, oh my God, I had no idea you guys were back. What happened?
Are they annoyed by the fact that we don't talk about photography very much? Maybe. I don't know.
Hey, we spent the first little bit, right?
Can I tell you something that happened to me after I left you there the other day on Sunday?
Yeah. I mean, and let me just say, it was about 1,000 degrees in DC.
Oh yeah. Yeah.
It was so hot.
Well, this happened on Sunday when it was a little cooler, but yeah.
Okay.
So I, as we all know, I love the moon landings.
Yes.
I'm an Apollo nut.
Yeah.
And one of my top five favorite places in the world is the Air and Space Museum on the Mall of Smithsonian.
That's where you ended up going after we left, right?
No, I didn't end up going. I ended up going on Sunday. Conrad and I went down there. And I get down there and I'm walking up to the door.
Right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's not the facade that I had a problem with.
Okay.
There is a sign as you're walking in. And I'm going to send you this sign.
Okay.
And then we're going to discuss it.
In the text here?
Yeah, sorry. Give me a second. I'm sending. Okay. And this is what it says. The sign, as I just sent to Jeffrey, says, no pass, no entry, with a QR code. Scan QR code to reserve your free passes. So.
Can you get a pass like immediately just by scanning the code?
I'll tell you about it.
All right.
So I have been to the Air and Space Museum basically since it was opened.
Yeah.
And I've been there, I don't know, dozens of times in my life. I absolutely love it.
You and I have been there a bunch of times.
It's one of my happy places.
Yeah. Yeah.
It used to be you just walk up and you walk in.
Yeah.
Then it was, you walk up, you walk in, and there's metal detectors.
Mm-hmm.
Now it's you walk up and you can't walk in without a time to pass.
And is this unique to Air and Space, or is it all of the Smithsonian's
now? I don't know, but I
now?
Think so.
Okay.
So I went onto the QR code. Oh, fine. I'll get this stupid, you know, go on
yeah,
the QR.
I'm gonna see if I can scan the QR code just from your image.
Okay. So you scan the QR code and you end up on a page. When would you like to visit? Tickets today? Yes. What time? Noon. Okay. How many tickets? Two. Okay. Great. Fill out this form. Name, email address, phone number, home address.
Really?
And I said, why do I have to give the Smithsonian my home address in order to visit a Smithsonian museum?
Wow.
I don't like that at all.
Oh, yeah. Look at that. Look at that.
And they're required.
Huh.
Now, you could put in 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue if you really wanted to, right? It's not going to whatever.
That would be kind of awesome, actually.
But I don't like that. The stuff that's in this museum is owned by me and you. It's not owned by...
Yeah.
They can't gatekeep me. And I don't like the fact that they're keeping a list of who's going in and out of the museum. It's a free museum. It's, you know... there's something about... It's very un-Smithsonian to me. And so I said...
I wonder when this started. Because the last time I was there, which was, I don't know, maybe 7-8 months ago, I don't remember seeing this.
Well, so I said to the woman who was there, just, you know, working woman outside, saying, oh, you got to do the code, blah, 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 blah. And I said, I'd rather not give my home address and phone number just to be able to walk into a Smithsonian museum. And she said, okay, well, go talk to that woman inside. So we go inside and I go over to this woman at like a little desk by the front door. And I said, hi, I'd like to get passes, but I don't want to give my home address and phone number. And she said, why not? And I said, because it's none of your business where I live.
Right. Unless you're going to send me a cake on my birthday, we've got nothing to talk about.
Yeah. And she, you know, bleep, 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 bleep on the computer and then said, yeah, you guys can go on in. But
Wow. What
does the sign say?
Yeah, no pass, no entry.
That's funny. I didn't have a pass and I entered.
So it's no pass, some entry.
Yeah. It's no pass, no entry unless you make a stink about it. And then it really turned me off.
It feels like the facial ID at the airport.
Yep. Which is, you know, just opt in now until 4 years from now when it's opt out. And then 3 years later, it's no opt out.
Right.
It's like frog in water.
Yeah. Yeah.
I don't
building the fence around the pigs.
Yep. I don't like it.
Yeah.
It made me very uncomfortable. And so we ended up going in and I saw the things I wanted to see. And my God, just seeing Columbia and seeing, you know, Armstrong's suit and seeing, you know, like,
yeah.
It's just,
and they've done a great job with the refit
of the Apollo stuff. They did a really nice job. Yes.
Yeah.
It's a little dark in there, but
yeah, it's a little dark.
But overall, I really like it. They moved the right flyer downstairs. And so on the other side. So like, that's nice. One thing I disagree with. Oh, you disagree with it too?
Perfect
corn
timing.
Outside. One thing I disagree with. They have a X-Wing fighter hanging up.
Yeah, I didn't.
Nope. That is fiction.
I don't put that up inside the
hall next to the Spirit of St. Louis and the X-1.
Yeah, and certainly don't take down something to make room for it.
Yeah. No, I don't like it.
Although they do have the, you know, the Close Encounters ship and the
Well, if
the
you
Enterprise
were going to show me models or something like that, that's one thing. But having a full-size model of an X-Wing up as if it's a real thing next to things that are real things, I feel like that blurs the line in a way that makes me uncomfortable in today's world because people are dumb and...
Maybe it's just, I mean, the cynic in me is like, it's to get the kids. It's to get more people to want to come if they can see an X-Wing than the X-1.
But then you see, nice one.
That was just for you. Don't tell me there's no love.
I worry about the father of that kid who's just like, see, it's fake there and it's fake in the other room too.
Oh yeah. Oh God, I didn't even think about that.
That's what I'm worried about. We didn't go we didn't go to the freaking moon. This is dumb.
It's in the Hall of Kubrick.
Yeah, my phone has more computer than that thing. There's no way they could have done it. We can't even do it now.
Yeah, yeah. Except that we did. But
okay. Yeah, we did. Yeah, we didn't do it, but we decided to do it six times.
Yeah, you know? Yeah.
Like, come on.
Yeah.
Anyway, that's just something that irked me the other day, and it's a whole thing.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen that. I kind of want to go down and see. Because my happy place has always been the National Gallery.
Well, the National Gallery we walked into after that. We went across the thing. We went into the National Gallery, walked in, nothing.
No QR code there.
But the National Gallery is not Smithsonian.
No, it's not part of the Smithsonian.
So I don't know if it's we didn't go to any of the other.
And now, did you see they're saying it's a mechanical issue, but the Hirshhorn is closed, the castle is closed, the Native American Museum is closed. The Asian American Museum is closed. They say there's a mechanical issue that they're working on.
What mechanical issue?
I don't know.
All right. I have a secondary topic here.
Yep. Hit me.
Finishing the unfinished. Jeffrey's like, my whole damn life.
Yeah. Do you want to talk about the deck that I haven't resurfaced, or the sink in the middle bathroom that I haven't finished?
Well, in this case, well, I mean, yes, all of those things could be true.
Creative projects.
Originally, it was creative projects.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
Okay. How often do you work on something, get far enough along, and never actually finish it, put it in a box, and put it on the shelf?
Used to be pretty often. I've changed modes. I'm in this sort of archivist catalog build an archive of my stuff that I still have access to mode. So I've been taking a break from creating anything new.
Okay.
Other than, you know, the only thing that I'm really kind of moving forward on making new things is plunking around on my synths. But okay, in terms of visual work, I haven't done anything in months because.
Well, so I've been obsessed with this band called Lawrence. Have we discussed Lawrence? Mm-hmm. Yeah. It's a brother sister duo with a band behind them, Clyde and Gracie Lawrence, in their 20s here in New York. She was in one of the shows on Broadway with Jonathan Groff. I think she got a Tony nomination, the sister. And he sings and plays piano and I think does a lot of the writing. And I think they're wonderful and I like their music and I like the way it feels and I like their whole vibe and
like Americana type stuff?
No, it's more like they've listened to a whole lot of Stevie Wonder and like gospel stuff. Like got this, like, it's like this gospel R&B vibe from these like two little Jewish kids. It's awesome.
Their signage reminds me of something like Dawes or, you know, like that kind of.
Feel. I'll put some tracks in the show notes so people can listen.
Okay.
In fact, there's one performance.
On their website, they've got 1, 2, 3, 4 YouTube videos on the homepage.
Oh, I mean, if you go to their YouTube stuff, they do it really well. They do sort of lip synced videos where they just set up a camera on a tripod and then they sit there and they kind of like dance around or whatever it is and lip sync to their song.
Yeah.
They do those videos, which are like super cheap music videos to do. Right.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But then they also do songs like there's this tune called 23, which is, you know, you said that 23 would be the best thing that ever happened to me, but you lied because 23 is, you know, because I'm 23 and that's a lie because you left me when I was 23. That's like the gist of the song. And they do a version on their tour bus where they like come up onto the tour bus and they're all in their little beds on the tour bus, all doing it live.
That's funny.
And they sound great because they're all serious players. You know what I mean? They're all like serious heavies. And it's adorable. And they're like dancing around the tour bus and they'll also do that, which they probably did in a couple hours, you know, they did a few takes of it or whatever.
Yeah, sure.
So that's up there, or they'll do live videos, or Clyde was on one of those, the piano, things, you know, like Drumeo, you know, where they show the guys.
Oh yeah. 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 I've watched a lot of the Stuart Copeland.
Right. So there's piano ones where he went on and played one of his songs or whatever. And I'll put that link in the show notes, but anyway, they're really good and I really like them. And it made me on one of their things they did was they rented a studio and they went in, I think probably for a couple of days, I'd guess, just based upon what I know about how these things are done. And they had a bunch of background singers and then they had their band and they did sort of covers, acoustic-y covers. In fact, there's a whole album on the streaming things called, I think it's acoustic-y, whatever, of them doing some of their songs, but just sort of different arrangements of them. And they have all these different singers singing backup. And then at the end of the song, they let each of them sort of sing a little bit. And actually one of the people who is one of their background singers is this girl, this woman who's in this band called Melt that I really like. She's the lead singer there. And she happens
Say
to be
again.
One of the Melt.
Melt.
Yeah. Okay. Also a really good record, like really good record. See, I'm listening to new music. But it's all new music that kind of sounds like old music, but I'll put that aside for a moment. So anyway.
What's old is new again.
One of the guys who sang one of the backup things was this. I mean, the guy, you could tell the guy can sing. And I had that song that I recorded a few years ago, that Time Stop song. And while I had a good performance for my lead vocal, I did not have a good recording of the good performance of the lead vocal. And the song, I think, sounds really great. The mix I had my friend Brian Cook in LA do is amazing. But the vocal recording was not good enough to meet the rest of it. And it drives me crazy. So I wrote this one guy who was one of the background singers on one of these tunes and was just like, hey, man, I was working on this thing. It's just for fun. I might be able to throw you a little money or trade you some photography, but would you be interested in listening and maybe doing a take or two?
Like to remix it or to sing
To re-sing it.
Yeah. Yeah. Okay.
And so he got back to me. He's like, yeah, send it to my email. So I sent all these files to him and some explanation and everything like that yesterday. And I'm waiting to hear back from him. But it's almost like it's this thorn in my foot that it's not finished.
Right.
You know, do you ever feel that way about stuff?
I have in the past.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, there are projects, ideas that I keep coming back to.
Because the idea was good, but your execution wasn't up to the idea or up to your idea of the idea?
Maybe. Or maybe it's a skill set thing.
Okay.
There's a story. Actually, there are two stories that I keep coming back to that I want to write out and finish. And I have scenes. I have index cards. I have bits and pieces of dialogue. I have storyboards in some cases of how I can see shots looking.
Yeah.
If it turned into a film or something like that. But for whatever reason, it's like, you know, that's never going to get any traction. Why bother?
Right.
Or it's, I don't know that I've got the skill set to write fiction, but I don't think you ever really know until you start writing fiction.
Yeah.
Right. It's that chicken and egg. Like, do I have the skill to do this? You might, but you've convinced yourself that you don't. So you probably don't.
I mean, for what it's worth, I feel that way and I've written a bunch of stuff. So
yeah.
I still feel
it is that sort of getting out of your own way for whatever the reason is, whatever your barrier, what you have to figure out your own barrier to entry.
Sure.
I think.
Yeah. And, but you know, for me, I guess there's a few folders.
Wait, so have you still not heard back from the guy? Sorry to interrupt.
Well, I just wrote him yesterday. So I haven't heard back from him in the past couple of days, but it's even just taking the steps of, you know what? That guy there, that thing's been annoying me. Look at that guy. He can sing.
Yeah. I got to cross this off my list somehow.
Yeah. Let's send that guy some stuff and see if he'll bite, you know? And I have to start moving again. It's making me crazy. I'm bad when I'm not busy. And so
I've, well, okay. That's a whole other thing.
No, it totally is. And but you know, there's some folders of pictures on my hard drive that I never got around to doing processing and finishing and whatever. And it's like, okay, I need to just, but to some extent, me not finishing them is almost an excuse not to finish them. Does that make sense? Them sitting there unfinished allows me to say, oh yeah, I don't need to go do new stuff because I have those things that I still haven't finished.
Right.
It's like, well, no. Get those off your desk.
Yeah.
Well, those are finished, and then you're back to a blank desk, and now you have to do something new.
I've had multiple iterations of a redesign of my website in folders since the end of last year.
Okay.
And I'm just like, meh.
Do you not like any of them?
No, I love them. But it's like, what's the point? What's my why for doing this? What's my why? Just to say I can?
What's your why for doing anything? No, I mean, that sounded bad.
It is a valid question, and it's something that is a recurring theme with my therapist.
Yep.
Is what is your why? Because I think if you don't have a clear idea of what your why is for any given project, topic, situation, it's easy to get lost in not knowing what your why is, and then you don't move forward. At least that's been my experience.
Do you think that, okay, I've talked to people about this too, professionals as it were.
Yeah. Yeah.
And the argument is that you do these big, long projects in order to keep yourself from looking at what's really making you sad or whatever. That they're actually a distraction and they're actually a bad thing in the short term because you're not doing them for the right reasons.
Yeah.
Do you think that to tie it back into what we talked about at the beginning of this conversation, if you were doing it for the things that you and I are not that into, like, no, your job right now, Jeffrey, is to get numbers. Because if you don't have numbers, there's no point in you making anything because no one's ever going to see it. So you got to make numbers. So you got to do this thing that you don't particularly even like doing, but at least that's a why.
Mm-hmm.
Would that why be good enough? Does any why work, or does the why have to have weight? Does that make sense?
I think it's situational.
Okay.
It depends on the situation. I think the season that I'm in right now is trying to get out of my head and intellectualize everything. Reasons for, reasons against. And just instead, and this is something that my therapist and I have been working on, is just sitting with things. Just sitting with it and noticing how it feels. Right?
Even you saying that makes me squirm.
I know. It's
because I go, what's the point of just sitting with make something?
Same. You know, and it's not the reason. It's one of the reasons that I am at this point in my life still unable to meditate.
Yeah.
The idea of sitting there, I cannot at this point. We've been working on that too. I find it very difficult to just clear my thoughts and sit with something. And now, if I do yoga has become my form of meditation because I have to focus on my breathing, on my balance, so I don't fall over. And in that respect, because I'm focusing on those things, the din of my everyday life subsides a little. The noise of my own existence is squelched a little bit.
Right, because you're thinking about something else.
Yes.
You're not thinking about nothing, as it were.
Right. But when I stop, once the sort of high of having done this yoga and holding these poses or whatever it is, once that sort of fades away, then that noise comes back.
Right. Yep.
So the goal right now is to sit with these things so that I don't have to come up with a why for every single solitary thing.
Right. Well, okay. But the I guess my problem with that theory, and again, not necessarily that I'm right, but the thing that comes into my mind, or the rebellion that happens inside of me, mm-hmm. is if things don't need a reason, or if that reason can be just arbitrary,
yeah,
it's what I feel like doing right now, or whatever.
Which is completely valid. And
yes, it is.
That's hard for me to reconcile just because I want to. And I think that's where where my synths, are almost the best therapy for that particular
situation.
There's
no stakes.
There's no stakes. I know that I am never going to be Thomas Oscar Dolby. Peterson or Herbie Hancock or Bill Wadman.
Sure.
I don't, you play things just kind of in the background that, you know, you've played stuff even when we're not on mic. You'll just grab your synth while we're talking or your keyboard rather, and you'll just play through something. And I'm like, fuck, if I could do that, like just that, like I don't, but I can't. And I know that I'm not going to be able to. I may learn a few chords here and there. I may learn, you know, a few little melodies. That's fine. To your point, there are no stakes. I can do these things just because I enjoy them. And when something comes out that I go, well, that doesn't suck. That's all I need. That's the achievement. That's the validation, is I could listen back to it and go, well, that's kind of catchy.
So what's the why there? The why is on the off chance is something
to
catchy
not
happens.
Have to have a why.
Yeah.
The why is because
see, to me,
you
then
can.
Why do it at all?
Because it brings me joy.
Yeah, see, that's the part that I bump on.
I will sit here, Bill, and fiddle around with sounds and arpeggios and you know, I don't know. Yeah, all those Berlin School enthusiasts.
Or as my friend Mark Hamilton on XM Radio says, bleep bloop music.
Yeah, bleep bloop music. Yeah, unsa music.
Yeah. Mm-ts, 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 mm-ts. Yeah. Pea soup, pea soup, pea soup.
Yeah. You know, what is it? Cats and something.
Yeah,
anyway,
I forget that one. Go ahead.
I enjoy it. And you know, am I going to be Lisa Belladonna just like flying up and down the keyboard and get sponsored by Moog and have this wall of modules? No.
Yeah.
But that's not the goal. The goal is just to do something that I enjoy that doesn't have to feel like it's productive. Yes, that's it. It doesn't have to feel productive.
You know, I said something to my wife a couple weeks ago. I said, you know, when you're younger, society has tricked us into thinking that our purpose in life is to work.
Yeah. To produce. Yeah. To achieve.
Yep.
Yeah.
And of course, that's not really true. I mean, I guess it's better in a capitalist system, or it's better in any sort of societal system if people produce, because if everyone's just sitting around not producing, then we're in trouble. But I think that it's made it feel like if you don't produce, then why bother being there? And the problem is that I find finishing things or making things satisfying. Maybe it is a distraction for me.
Yeah. Yeah.
But it's better than the alternative.
Yes. And yes. And, as Adrian likes to say, you and I both suffer from
megalomania.
the idea that I think you and I both suffer from guilt around not being productive, and you don't have to share it, but if you feel comfortable, would you mind sharing the story of the baseball game?
Oh, I going to baseball games?
The one with your friend at
Coney Island, yeah.
Yeah. If that's too much, don't worry.
Well, no, I feel like having fun is wrong.
Yeah.
For lack of a better word.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I deserve to have fun.
Yeah.
I don't feel like I should have the right to have fun.
Yeah.
And even if I'm there, I shouldn't, I should squander my enjoyment of it. Even if I am enjoying it, I should do things to sabotage that enjoyment.
Yeah.
In my head.
Or find some way to come home with something productive that you can use on something else. So it wasn't just.
Yes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I can't just go and I would rather sit here and toil away and not produce anything rather than go outside and have a good time and definitely not produce anything.
I'm sorry. I'm laughing because this is what we talked about at lunch and we're both just like, yeah.
It's I know it's weird. I mean, this goes back to, I don't know. I guess it goes back to my childhood. I don't know. I don't like having fun. I don't like watching other people have fun. I don't enjoy it.
And the thing that I hope I'm not overstepping, but one of the things around the game was I'm sitting here having fun while Heather's at work.
Well, a lot of times, yeah, a lot of times that's true.
And it's like, who the hell am I to have fun when
my partner's working? Yeah.
Yeah. And that's something that, you know,
but the reality is that our lives are not the same life. And I'm sure that they would say that the whole point of it is so I can go do stuff when one of us can go do stuff, you know?
Yep.
And that's totally valid, but I mean, that is probably the correct way to think about it. I'm unable to think about it that way.
Same. Yeah.
It's really interesting.
Mm-hmm.
The whole, I would rather not have fun. I would rather be miserable than have fun somehow. I don't know.
Yeah. And not all the time, of course.
No.
I mean, because
it's also not that I want to feel miserable.
Yeah.
It's that I shouldn't be able to feel joy. I shouldn't enjoy something.
Somehow misery has become the byproduct of joy.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. And it's something I'm working on actively.
Same. Yeah.
Because the reality is that we have X amount of years in this world.
Yep.
You a few less than me, but
wow. There it is.
I'm gonna get struck down by a cancer diagnosis any minute now.
1 hour 7:42 in before, yeah.
But I think that we're all gonna die someday. So why are we feeling guilty about living?
You know, I had a friend in high school whose father used to always tell him if it was supposed to be fun, they wouldn't call it work.
Right. I mean, that's the classic line, but that also seems insane to me.
Yeah. Yeah.
That almost feels masochistic to me. But then again, somebody would say the way I see the world is masochistic.
Yeah. Yeah.
So who am I to judge? You want your work to actually be enjoyable, you fool. You know?
You really are an idiot, aren't you?
Yeah. Yeah, it's I don't know, it's a tricky one. It's something I've been flirting with and trying to figure out, and it's yeah. Do you know that there's a we can come back to that when I have deeper thoughts on it.
Okay.
Have you seen, there's somebody who put up a thing the other day talking about how AI is not going to, that there's bad art, there's okay art, and then there's exceptional art. And that.
Wait, say that again, please.
There's like three, art comes in a spectrum. There's, you know, bad art, medium art, and amazing art.
Yeah. Okay. Okay.
And that.
All subjective, but yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah. But the idea is that AI is never probably going to make much amazing art, but it'll make that middle thing even taller. Like that, it'll make okay art as much as you want.
Yeah.
But it's never going to make amazing stuff.
The bell curve won't be so deep in the middle.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
Or the upside down bell curve will get taller. Yeah. Or whatever. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And somebody said that the problem with that is that we need bad art. We need people. We need the idea of seeing things that are terrible, because that's how you get to be amazing, is to make things that are terrible. And if the things that come out right from the beginning are, yeah, pretty good, we never see anything bad, and so we never make anything new.
Yeah, I think that's true. And I think that's I also think that's largely the problem with reach becoming the metric by which quality is measured.
Yes. Yes. Right. Yeah.
Oh, I posted this, and it got 1,000 likes, so I'm going to post more of that, because what I really want are likes.
And it's funny, because all of those systems are designed to, they'll even tell you, Jeffrey, that last post you put on was seen by 15,000 people.
Yeah.
Do more like that. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
They don't say do more like that because we made more ad revenue off of that post. They don't say that.
Right.
But that's what it's about.
Of course. Yeah. 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 And it's maybe I just need to make more bad art.
I think everybody needs to make more bad art. You know, as we're sitting here thinking about this, I'm still 15 minutes behind thinking about why don't you write these bad fiction pieces? You're not going to get better unless you do.
Yep. Well, there's the big saying in screenplays and writing in general, like, get a first draft down.
Yeah.
Doesn't matter how good or bad it is. In some ways, the worse, the better. And then revise it from there. Mm. Right. I think that I saw a thing once with Stallone talking about, I think, writing the first Rocky script. And he's just like, when you're writing, he's just, don't worry. It doesn't need to be the right word. You just need to get like the structure. What's happening in the scene? Okay. Rocky and Adrian are doing such. All right. So he says to her, you want to go on a date? And she says, no. Okay. But just even get that down. And then you can make the no more eloquent. You can make the ask of the date more eloquent. Like basically create the structure by putting something down on paper, and you can revise from there.
Mm.
I myself, this is like the similar to the people who say, don't even start writing until you have your structure all figured out.
Right.
For something, you know, have your outline somewhat finalized before you even start writing. It'll make everything easier, blah, 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 blah. The problem is I enjoy the actual just writing part. So I will have a kernel, personally, this is just the way I do it. I will have a kernel of an idea of what the whole thing is, but I'll know, oh, this scene is going to be fun to write. Let me just write that scene and start building out from there.
Mm.
Or even worse, I have this one line that somebody's going to say, and I'll build out from there.
Mm.
Like, I know one line. Yes. He's going to say to her, you know, why do you have to be that way? You know, why do you have to like decaf over regular coffee or whatever the thing is? Right.
Yeah. 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 Yeah.
And like, that will be sort of the seed that everything crystallizes upon. It's like a super saturated solution that just needs a seed.
Mm.
For me, that's the way I work. But then there's other people.
If that works for you, that's great.
Right. And the basic outline thing works for Sly. So maybe for you, it's somewhere in the middle or one of those ends. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Yeah.
But
or there's Tarantino, who just says he lets the characters write, that he doesn't really think about it. He just starts writing and lets the voices of the character come through him.
Right. Yeah. In some weird, creepy, holy way that he's, you know, he's got tarot cards and a Ouija board. Yeah. But you know what, you're right. So maybe nothing ever comes of it. Maybe you put it up on Amazon for as a self-published things and you sell 15 copies. Okay.
I mean, it worked for Andy Weir.
Yes. Yeah. He started on a website.
Yeah.
So yeah, I mean, I think that, is it really just that you don't think it's going to be good or that no one's going to see it anyway? So why bother?
Are you asking me?
You.
Oh yeah. I don't necessarily even think about whether it's going to be good. There are so many there are so many plot holes that I've yet to sort out. And I have this weird belief that I have to have that sorted out before I write. But the reality is probably closer to what we've talked about here is those plot holes get sorted out as you write.
Yeah. And you may end up having to, like, I'm making some changes in one of my scripts right now where somebody says, oh, you know, this character needs to get pushed up a little bit. And I was like, okay. But it's like you start taking it apart and it's a little bit of a Jenga pile.
Yeah.
You know, like, oh crap. If he does that here, then that changes how this affects here. And that cascades all the way down. I got to change a lot of things now to make that work or whatever. Sometimes
the key is in, you're a musician. Maybe one of the keys anyway is in improvisation. Just write,
yep.
You know, in this, like, how many times do you just sit down at your piano and just plunk around and yep. Maybe a phrase comes out of it. Maybe it doesn't, but nothing's going to come out without your hands in motion.
I like writing dialogue, and I write dialogue in almost real time. Like, I can't keep up with my thoughts. I can't type fast enough to sort of, because I just have a conversation with myself in my head.
Yeah. Do you use voice memos?
No.
At all?
It's funny. I use a piece of software called Highland to write.
Highland?
Yeah. It's,
I don't know this one.
It's, what's his name? Started it. John August, who wrote Big Fish and a bunch of other movies.
Oh yeah.
So he hated Final Cut. And so he made this software called Highland that uses, it's basically a markdown format called,
Highland with a Y. Okay.
Different
piece of software.
Yeah. Sorry.
Highland Pro screenwriting software for Mac. Okay. Got it.
It's only for Mac, and
it's weird that there are multiples.
There's another Highland
one
and it's called Highland. I see where you're going there. Yeah, they've recently made it, what's it called? They've recently made it a subscription, which I'm not a huge fan of. I use an older version that's non-subscription, but I understand, you know, they got to make a living.
What's the subscription called? Oh, wow, look at this. Phil Lord says, Highland is just cleaner, purer way to be creative. My mind is calmer and less cluttered when I use it because I can write prose so easily and jump to dialogue when that's more intuitive. Phil Lord. Writer, producer, Spider-Man Into the Spider-Verse, writer, director, the Lego Movie, 22 Jump Street, and Project Hail Mary.
The format is called Fountain. It's basically a markup superset.
Huh.
There's a bunch of them. There's one called, it's not Subscene. There's another one. There's a bunch of Fountain editors, and a lot of text editors can now edit Fountain. It's just like,
so wait, it's a subset of Markdown?
It's a superset of Markdown. So it's like Markdown plus screenwriting specific tags. So that if you look at a file, it just looks like a text file with a whole bunch of, you know, like quotes and things around stuff that when you open up in a Fountain reader shows up as a screenplay. It's an open format. Anybody can use it. It can bring in final draft documents apparently and all kinds of stuff, but I just use it. I love writing in it because it can just be nothing. Like, you could have no sidebar and you're just typing. And if you type in a character name, hit enter and just start typing what they say and hit enter, type in a character name, hit enter, and it'll auto complete a bunch of stuff. And it's really intuitive. And then it's got this whole sidebar that you can add. You can add on this, the sidebar, you can jump between scenes. You can, keep clips of text that you're working on, all kinds of stuff. I like it a lot.
It's cool. It looks clean.
Yeah, I'm a big fan of Highland.
What is it? $60 a year.
Is that what they charge for? Okay.
Mm-hmm. $10 a month or $60 a year.
I mean, that's not terrible. If you're a writer in any real way, that's not bad at all. It is the best software I've found for. I'm using an older version that it used to charge like $50 flat fee. So I bought that one and I'm still using it. Although it's having a few little bugs with the new OS stuff that's going on, like the changes they've made in display stuff have caused a few little display bugs. So I may have to jump to the new one eventually. But what are you going to do?
Yeah. Do they give you any sort of discount as a previous?
It's a good question, actually. I don't know. Yeah. They're always trying to get you to use the new one. Like, update Highland. I'm like, I don't want to update Highland. I don't want to update.
Yeah. It's only 4 o'clock. I don't want to come in.
Yeah. And it does, you know, it makes automatic backups every 15 minutes. And it, you know, it's really slick. If you want to try writing, try Highland. It's really good.
Yeah. That's nice.
But, I think you should start writing.
I enjoy writing. Writing is the thing that I have gotten, I think, demonstrably better at over the years. And I think a big part of that is just I do it all the time. But I write every day.
Have I ever read anything narrative of yours?
No.
Okay.
No, other than sort of anecdotal things that I put in newsletters. But no. You know, it gets back to what we were talking about earlier of finishing. I've started a bunch of things.
Yeah.
Short stories, scripts, you know, I just, maybe, you know what? I've got a bunch of time this week. Adrian is up in New Hampshire. So I've got lots of time.
Yeah.
Maybe I'll take my MacBook and go sit at a coffee place and write.
I end up going to libraries and I listen to Rain on my headphones.
Oh, yeah.
If I'm writing new stuff, I can't listen to anything with lyrics, obviously.
No.
But if I was revising, I could listen to stuff with lyrics, weirdly enough.
No, I have to have just instrumental.
Yeah. I have a recording that I had years ago. Some guy had a DAT deck and a pair of a stereo mic and got caught in a rainstorm underneath like a shed.
Like a tin roof type thing?
Yeah, in Hawaii. Yeah.
Love it.
And he just like hit record and it's an hour long and it was released on CD.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Can you put a link in the show notes to it?
Yeah, I'll see if I can find it. I have a rip of it, but I ripped of the CD, but it's pretty cool. Hey, one last thing here for you. Did you see that apparently iOS 27 inside some of the code is a reference to, quote, Apple reference image, end quote, a photo provenance system that will verify if an image was captured with an iPhone and a specific iPhone at a specific time. And it'll like tag it as this picture was taken at this time, at this place. And we sort of, have you seen the stuff that Leica is trying to do and Adobe are trying to do? Basically saying this is a photograph right out of a camera and it hasn't been edited.
Hmm.
It's called.
Is it a response against AI or?
Yes.
Or?
Yeah. And I think people messing with images in news stuff. There's a thing called C2PA content credentials for authentication that Leica, Sony, and Nikon use.
Huh.
And Google adopted it for their Pixel 10 line. And I think Apple's trying to do the same kind of thing. So somebody can't say, oh, it's just a fake video. It's like, no, it's not a fake video or a fake image. Like, this was taken by this phone.
Does
at this
it
time.
Store it in metadata or does it so require it says, some other reading?
According to the text, there will be a reference mode option in the camera app that users can select. Using this mode will embed provenance data into the image's metadata. Images captured with an opt-in reference mode can be authenticated to confirm they were taken with an iPhone. Authenticating is done by tapping the reference badge on the image, which sends the raw image sensor signatures, capture time frame and the unique hardware identifiers of the sensor to the Apple private cloud compute servers. Private cloud compute uses the information to determine whether the camera captured the photo, gives it a unique ID, and then returns an authenticated version to the user's device.
Huh.
When authenticating,
how does it handle any sort of editing? Are you not allowed to even edit like white balance, exposure, that kind of thing?
Yeah, I don't know. When authenticating a photo, Apple receives the sensor data, a hash, and the assessment results, but not the raw photo. Apple can refuse to authenticate images from a sensor that might be compromised, and it can retroactively revoke a past sensor's authentications. Authenticated photos can be viewed on iPhone, Apple, Mac, and the reference badge can also be clicked on a Mac. Images that have been captured in the Apple's specific reference mode to be authenticated, which suggests it's a feature aimed at pro photographers, journalists, and others who need to verify images. There may be a video component since Apple's disclosure mentions photos or videos and uncropped footage. Interesting, though, right?
Yeah. I mean, again, I it sounds like there's kind of a fuzzy line between what is considered processing and what is considered.
Sure. I think this is more of, I think this is for political dissidents and journalists and stuff where it's like, nope, this is the photo, you know? Yeah. I think if you could use all of those tools on the Apple camera app now that do, you can have the different looks and things, you know, baked in.
Yeah.
I think those things are fine.
Yeah. That's different than like removing a palm tree or.
Exactly. Yes.
Yeah.
Anyway, I just thought that was kind of interesting.
At the hardware level, that's really kind of wild.
Well, I mean, it's pulling hardware metadata and then creating a software thing that gets put on there. But I think that this is good. I think that, I mean, nothing that I shoot needs to be certified in this way.
Right. But did you say it was opt-in or is it default?
Yeah, you have to turn it on. You have to turn on this reference mode. So I think it's just, you know, like if I need this to be, this is the photo of somebody getting sworn in on this, you know, as attorney general or whatever it is, you know, like that kind of stuff. Because that's going to be the thing that's going to be in there for history or perpetuity or whatever. Yeah.
Yeah.
I just thought that was kind of neat.
Huh. Yeah. I hadn't seen that.
Yeah. See, it's good stuff. Do you have somebody for Photographer of the Week? I had somebody last week.
You had somebody last week and you didn't use them. We used Alexander.
Hiromix. Hiromix.
Spell it, please.
Hiromix.
Oh, just like it sounds. Okay.
Japanese Hiromix. Photographer. This is something that
Hiromi Toshikawa.
Yep. Did not know who this person was.
What a great name.
But apparently,
Hiromi Toshikawa,
born in 76, so about my age. But she won in 1995. She won the New Cosmos of Photography Award, sponsored by Canon. And her awarded 17 girl days consisted of 50 pages of photographs from her daily life. Life as a high school senior, self-portraits in her underwear, objects in the room such as the television and stuffed animals, photographs of her half-eaten breakfast, blurred portraits of her friends and daily activities, images that helped build a world of intimately feminine, personal, and unknown to the nation accustomed to overly sexualized representations of women, and of course by men. In the same year, Studio Voice magazine specialized in the youth movements, but with a base of middle-aged photographers who had nothing to do with their readers, issued a volume dedicated to young photographers trying to find a new platform. Hiromix, then 18 years old, was one of those photographers who answered the call, and her work reached a commercial milestone with the publication of Volume 236, captivating audiences, blah, 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 blah. The thing that I find interesting about this is the fact that she basically is doing social media Instagram photos 20 years early.
Hmm.
You know what I mean? In the mid 90s, she's basically taking the same pictures people are taking now and putting up on Instagram. She was doing it with a film camera in the 90s, like very ahead of her time kind of.
Is she still active?
I do believe that she is. They talk about her. I found this article and I found it somewhere else. I can't remember where I came upon her work. Originally, but it made me think, how have I never even heard her name?
Yeah. In 2000, Takashi Murakami founded Superflat, the artistic movement that ended up ruling Japanese aesthetic and psyche during the first decade of the 2000s. Hiromix work were included in Superflat's presentation exhibition at the Shibuya Parco Gallery with artists like Masafumi Sanai, Chikashi Suzuki, Aya Takano, Katsushigi Nakashi, and Murakami himself, solidifying her position as part of the vanguardist artistic generation for the end of the century. Wow.
Interesting, right?
I'm sorry for butchering those names. I probably did, but apologies.
I just, it's like there was this entire,
this whole, like almost subculture that we are completely unaware of.
That's exactly what I'm saying. Yeah.
Wow.
And apparently, like, yeah, that super flat movement was inspired by manga and anime and all the rest of it, but.
Interesting. Yeah, I have no reference. I have no point of reference for this at all.
Yeah.
And I kind of love that.
Right. So I just thought,
how often, okay, next time,
yep,
can you write a note? How often are we surprised by new work?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Anyway,
this
I just,
what a cool site this is too. Sabukaru?
Yeah.
Sabukaru. And I know I'm probably butchering that
this,
too.
This is also, I think it's a magazine or something, a magazine, oh, online magazine. I also think that this is very much your style of design and era of feel, like the way this site is.
Yeah.
Is up your alley.
Well, see, now I have to redo my unreleased site.
Yet now again. You got to change your site to whatever now this is.
Start doing it again. Great. Thanks, Bill.
But this 17 girl days, I think, is, you know, sort of the William Eggleston's guide of this subculture and generation.
Yeah. I mean, it's, and I think there's some truth to that in the sense that as I'm looking at this for the first time, I'm questioning what I'm looking at, but I'm not looking away from it. I'm still looking at more.
Yep.
So there's something there that interests me. Yeah. I mean, this is really interesting.
Apparently I found another website on, Canon has a website apparently above about this. Oh yeah. Here we go. Sending it to you. Mm-hmm. I think this is, the pictures from this series.
Oh yeah. Oh wow. Look at these.
Or a bunch of,
oh yeah,
pictures.
Could absolutely see this as kind of an updated sort of Eggleston-y kind of thing.
Yeah.
You know, like there's nothing technically brilliant about any of these photographs.
No, that's not what it's about.
That's not what it's about. Interesting. Yeah, cool stuff.
Do you
stuff.
Think you and I think too? Well, that's another topic for us.
Yeah.
Do we worry too much about technical?
I don't think I do anymore. I really don't. I've gone back to oops, shooting with my X-Pro 1. So
yeah, we noticed.
Oh, snap. Oh, it's on. It's on.
That's good stuff. Do you have anything to say before we wrap this up?
No, this is a good one. Good one. Thank you for being here. Thanks for continuing to come back. And you know, listen to
I have to be here, Jeffrey. I'm part of the show. Oh, you mean the listeners.
Oh, right.
Yes.
Smartass.
We love all of you and we're happy that you're here. It is, what is it? Podcast@ontakingpictures.com.
Yep.
If you want to send us an email, it goes to both of us.
We've been getting a lot of spam lately.
Like, we have been getting a lot of spam, but you know what?
Whatever.
I don't care. As long as I can find find the good stuff within the spam. Maybe I could turn on a spam filter on the server.
Yeah, that'd be good.
But it did tag a few things that weren't spam as spam.
Oh,
so that's the problem.
I keep seeing these things going to podcasts like we've taken over your computer. I'm like, really? Have you?
You took over my computer? I like when they're just like your American Express bank account for On Taking Pictures. And I was like, right. Oh, really? Did I? I had that American Express account. That'd be great. Somebody else set that up for us.
Yeah, because there's nothing there. Thank you.
Jeffrey, you go have a good week, and we will talk to you soon.
Yep, talk to you later.
Going on and on the way we are for so long. Too many fools, it's plain to see something's wrong. As this way, say what you wanna say. The way I have for too long. this way. Say what you wanna say. I know what you will say.